Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So when I was a kid, I remember being so grossed out by bugs. I literally wouldn't even touch this magazine one time because it had a picture of roaches on it, which is, you know, a little on the neurotic side, but pretty natural, right? Or maybe my aversion to bugs was just a product of an arbitrary set of values and conditioning that has little or nothing to do with how humans can choose to interact with the natural world. Our friend, the writer and podcaster Soleil Ho, is fascinated by the culture of insect eating. And she traveled to Japan to visit a village where it's all about pride, heritage, generosity, taste, and flavor. You know, normal food stuff.
The people of Kushihara have an age-old obsession with wasps. I'm talking about Vespula flaviceps, a species of flying insect known in central Japan for its exquisite deliciousness. In this rural mountain village, the wasp is celebrated as a seasonal wild food, like matsutake mushrooms, that peaks in late autumn as their nests swell with wiggly, buttery larvae. In the West, we tend to think of entomophagy, or the eating of insects, as the domain of friendly bugs like crickets and mealworms. Bugs that are amenable to being processed into flours, chips, and protein bars. In 2013, the United Nations' Food and Agriculture Organization released a blockbuster report that emphasized entomophagy's role in creating a sustainable source for food for our planet's growing population. Since then, people in the West have been racing to find the silver bullet that would get mainstream eaters on board.
Because if the global population does cross the 9 billion mark by 2050, the Food and Agricultural Administration estimates that the world food production will have to increase by roughly 70%. Yikes. So, are crickets the answer? The boys at Koala Valley Farms think so. We talked with Peter, aka Mama Bear.
In the palm of their hands.
We're definitely at the cutting edge. Our time has come.
Bugs are definitely the future.
And they're betting bugs are worth big bucks.
The key idea is we can use edible insects to bring our global food system into the future because they're nutritious, sustainable, and efficient. But wasps, which kind of terrify us out west, aren't often included in the conversation. They're, unsurprisingly, a pain to deal with. So why go through all that trouble? When I went to Kushihara this past November, I carried questions like that with me. Questions like, are wasps all that tasty? Why are they so meaningful for the people in Kushihara? And what does it mean to have such a symbiotic relationship with creatures that we so often fear in the West? During the town's wasp festival, the Hebomatsuri, which is held on November 3rd every year, I learned just how intimate and meaningful that relationship could be. The people of this region have been eating and celebrating their edible insects for centuries. The practice is as casual as keeping an apple tree in the yard. While I was in Kushihara, I stayed with Tetsuo and Sayoko Nakagaki, a couple who raise wasps, which they call hebo, in their backyard. That's Sayoko, showing me the three wooden boxes they keep their hebo in. In the springtime, they look for wild nests in the forest nearby and dig them out. She told me that they keep the wild nests, which often start off the size of tennis balls, in those hive boxes. This is where they grow. Over the summer and fall, the hebo are fed a steady diet of sugar water, honey, and raw chicken meat. The nests are ready to harvest when they get big and full of larvae. Humans also offer protection from bad weather and predators, so it's a pretty good deal for the wasps. As Sayoko led me through their yard and into their rows of beans, tomatoes, and peppers, I realized that wasp keeping for them was just like tending an apple tree at home. You take care of it and feed it throughout the year so that, when the time comes, you can enjoy its fruit and fill your freezer. When you think about Japanese food, you think ocean fish, right? You think of sushi, sashimi, that sort of stuff. But the town of Kushihara is in Gifu Prefecture, located pretty much dead center in Japan. They have no access to the ocean. So since they live in one of the few landlocked regions of the country, the residents have historically relied on foraging, hunting, and small-scale vegetable and rice farming for their food. It's clear that wasp rearing has historically been an important part of a seasonal rhythm here, though nowadays most of the people involved are men in their 60s, like Tetsuo. The Nakagaki story is pretty typical. Their adult children sought out opportunities in the big cities, while their parents keep up the old way of life at home. Tetsuo is also a prolific hunter of another insect endemic to the area, Japanese giant hornets, which they call Osuzumebachi. While the mature hornets aren't really good for eating, their larvae are. They taste meaty and rich, with an almost shrimp-like texture. In their nest, they make this beautiful crunching sound. They're hungry, and so are we. In preparation for the annual wasp festival, organizers Shoko and Daisuke Miyake make the event's specialty, gohei mochi, or grilled sticky rice. I went over to their house to watch them and their daughters make the tare, or sauce, for the mochi. I'm asking, how many gohei mochi do you need to make for the festival? And Shoko told me 1,300. I was amazed.
1,300.
The young Miyake family's tare recipe is rock solid. Daisuke hand grinds peanuts into a paste by using a wooden pestle in a giant bowl with grooves on the inside, called a suribachi. He keeps the bowl steady on the floor with his knees while the kids grind the larvae in a smaller version of that. To make the sauce, they combine equal parts soy sauce, white sugar, and the peanut butter with year-old miso, ginger, and the mashed hebo larvae. Their kids grew up making this stuff. You can tell by the way they beg their mom for a taste. The mashed larvae add a note of slick fattiness to the sauce, though their mild flavor is subsumed by the saltiness that coats your mouth. But this is nothing compared to how it tastes when grilled, which I found out later. The next day, I went to the community center to help Shoko and her crew of hired hands make the 1,300 mochi they'd need for the festival. So here's how that process goes. The 200 pounds of rice, which is grown in Kushihara, gets washed, then steamed. Two folks crouch down to pound the hot rice with wooden pestles in a tub. This isn't like the gooey mochi you'd find wrapped around sweet bean paste at a grocery store. The end product comes out with the same toothy texture as a spoonful of steel-cut oats. Then they portion out the rice in balls, about 5 ounces each. Finally, they're molded around flat cedar sticks and left to dry in wooden boxes until they get a little hard on the outside. Now repeat that 1,299 times. Shoko, who was born in Akechi, a nearby town, does this work because she believes in the importance of the festival to her community. I asked her about the history of the festival and wasp rearing while she wiped down cedar sticks for the next batch of mochi. She also told me that before, the hebo contest used to be a competition of who could find the biggest nest out in the wild. But nowadays, actually finding sizable nests has gotten more and more difficult.
But now, it is hard to find the natural one, no big one. So, now they are...
Why is it so hard to find the natural big ones?
Many people get from in summer, or the environment is changing. So,
so it's pesticides, popularity, and environment. All of those things.
Make yeah. It. So. Yeah. Coffee break. Dozo.
On the day of the festival, the 1,300 gohei mochi are grilled, basted with a sauce Shoko's family made, then grilled again. The taste of wasp larva is subtle, but a slight char on the grill makes their sweet nuttiness go into overdrive. No wonder the lines for their stall remained about 40 people deep all day. While some folks like me were taking photos and asking tons of questions, most attendees were old hands at this. It was more like a community party than a stunt food attraction, and influencers were few and far between. It was, all told, pretty normy. People like Tetsuo and Shoko usually take the festival as an opportunity to hang out with old friends and commemorate yet another autumn. That said, the main event is certainly the Hebo contest. In a huge mesh tent in the center of the area, festival staff carefully extract each of the participants' nests from their wooden boxes and pile each one into a clear garbage bag. The nests are then set on a scale in front of a huge crowd. The weights are announced and the bags are labeled with tape. The mood is casual, yet heavy with anticipation. According to Tetsuo, the majority of nests weigh in at 2 kilograms, or 5-ish pounds. As it turned out, the winner's nest was a whopping 6.5 kilograms, or 14 pounds. When I asked Tetsuo what the winner actually got, he shrugged and said essentially, street cred. His ended up being about 2 kilograms, though he said he's not like those retired guys who have the time to feed his nest chicken all day. He actually has a job to go to. Fair enough.
We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back in a minute with more of Salejo's visit to Japan. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back with more of Salejo's visit to Kushihara Village in Japan, where she saw the seasonal wasp harvest.
While standing in line for gohei mochi, we happened to run into Joost van Eeterbeek, a Belgian researcher. Remember that FAO study I mentioned earlier? The one that sparked the edible insect gold rush? He's one of its co-authors.
So you generally feel a positive attitude now with these insects coming up, trying to popularize this in Western cultures?
I would say that currently, the fashion with which people are trying to popularize them is very much based in flawed thinking and flawed advertising.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen it as well. Yeah. You know, I think there are the majority of people we've talked to in the United States would be interested in insects as a powder, which I find really sad because so much of the pleasure of eating an insect is from the texture and from the actual flavor. But the impulse to hide it as if it is something inherently disgusting rather than something to savor and enjoy on its own and like bring out all of the best aspects of in your cooking, it makes it seem less like a food and more like a vitamin that you take.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's the road they're focusing on now. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Supplement for just for the nutritional benefits, and mm-hmm. that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit like Soylent Green, you know? But, you know, obviously...
It meant a lot to me to know that Yost agreed with me. My misgivings about the edible insect trade in the West were why I'd come all the way to Kushihara, after all. In the end, I walked away from the conversation with the impression that he carried some regret over the small part he'd played in turning edible insects into a fad. After the festival, we left with Tetsuo to sell a portion of his nest to a local restaurant. The going price for a wasp nest is about $36 per pound, though you still have to do all the larva extraction yourself. Though we could have sold them the entire nest, Tetsuo chose to take half of it home with him. When we got back to the house, Sayako lined the dinner table with newspaper, Tetsuo cracked open some barley beers, and we all got to work on the nests. The pieces of nest are like a broken pomegranate. Instead of seeds, though, they're filled with glistening larvae, arranged in orderly hexagons. Older generations are more developed, with identifiable faces and body parts, while the younger ones are wiggly, pudgy grubs. We spent the night of the festival plucking the wasps out with tweezers, drinking and chatting while variety shows played on in the background. Once in a while, a fully formed adult would emerge from a cell, and Tetsuo would quickly decapitate it with his tweezers before it got too far. It was easy to fall into a trance and just pluck, pluck, pluck away. After we got a good pile going, Sayako simmered the larva in a pot with sugar, sake, chopped ginger, and soy sauce. That method of cooking is called tsukudani. People make all kinds of things that way, not just insects. The first batch got away from her and burned a bit, so she tried again. This time, we stared down at the pot as it cooked. She had eyeballed the ingredients and cooked them for about 11 minutes, just enough time for them to soak up the flavors and firm up. The larva didn't taste so buttery anymore. The texture was way meatier, almost like bits of ground chicken. For the people of Kushihara, a hefty dollop of these on a bowl of steamed rice is the ultimate fall dish. This approach to edible insects is far from futuristic, and it's definitely not efficient enough to feed the world's growing population. In fact, so much of wasp culture in Kushihara is centered on being in the present moment, in a certain place, at a certain time. Wasps are, more than anything, a fleeting mark of the fall season. You spend months cultivating the nests, just for that moment when you pop a raw larva into your mouth and it bursts into a flash of honey butter.
That piece was produced for us by Soleil Ho, and the reporting for that piece was supported by the UC Berkeley 11th Hour Food and Farming Journalism Fellowship. Soleil's graphic novel, Meal, came out on Christmas, and then in January, she moved to California to be the San Francisco Chronicle's new restaurant critic. She is flourishing. Now, after hearing about those wasps, which, you know, obviously are probably not coming to a Whole Foods near you anytime soon, I'd still bet there are plenty of listeners who were perfectly comfortable with that story. And some who'd really rather not. Chris Ying is one of the founders of the food magazine Lucky Peach and is the editor of an essay collection called You and I Eat the Same. So I asked him, really? You think?
Well, you and I don't eat the same, right? That's the truth of the matter. On our day-to-day experience, what you had for lunch today, what I had for lunch today, they're very different. What you grew up eating is different from what I grew up eating. Although I would wager that what you and I grew up eating is pretty similar.
Probably.
But in general, difference is important. Difference is everything. It creates identity. It creates pride, economic opportunity for people, especially when it comes to food. But this book's title, You and I Eat the Same, was this hypothesis, this question I had that was, how do we bridge these divides with the other side of the political spectrum or the cultural spectrum, people who I don't agree with? How do I speak to them? And the answer to me was not dwelling in difference, was to try to find some kind of common ground. And we came up with this book title. I called it You and I Eat the Same before the book was done, before I had any idea whether or not this hypothesis would be proven out. But it was sheerly because I wanted to have a statement that united us rather than trying to point out our differences.
But I want to get into the pros and cons, I guess, of believing in that statement, You and I Eat the Same. Because, you know, there are nuances, right? And it goes beyond all rose-tinted glasses, like, oh, we're all alike. And then the other side of it, which is, ew, no, what you eat is disgusting. I hate you. There's a lot of room in between those poles, right? So let's get into some of the things in the book. One of the things I was really excited to read was Tianlan Ho's piece about how sesame is actually pretty close to being like a universal ingredient. It's totally central to many Chinese cuisines, Japanese cuisine, Syrian cuisine, Lebanese cuisine, Israeli cuisine, and it's on McDonald's buns, right? It's on the Big Mac buns. So there are ways in which we do eat the same and we don't even know it.
That's right. I mean, I love this exercise. You know, when you first started talking about sesame, I wonder what your listeners' minds drifted to, the first dish that people thought of when you said sesame. And chances are, you know, it had to do with the last thing they ate that had sesame on it, or the thing they grew up eating with sesame on it. For me, you know, growing up Chinese American, my mind goes to the same things that the writer of that piece, Tian Lun's, mind went to too. It goes to tang yuan, you know, these sesame filled glutinous rice balls. I think that I'm probably in the, you know, for lack of a better word, minority in thinking of that. But sesame comes from Africa. And I like to think about these ingredients as having some sort of consciousness almost. They're so successful. They're like, they adapt wherever they go. They're so useful for so many different culinary purposes. We plant them wherever we can. People buy them all over the world. And that species has propagated because it's succeeded everywhere. But wherever it is, you know, people will say like, oh, I feel like sesame is our flavor. Sesame belongs to us. And like you said, like you rightly pointed out, Americans eating at McDonald's will have a sesame seed bun every day. And in some senses, like it feels very American in that way, the sesame seed bun. And so all of those differences and the different ways that sesame is applied are so important. But maybe recognizing that layer underneath that, hey, this is the same thing, and we're all eating it in different ways. You know, as different as we might seem, there's some commonality here. And if we're going to try to bridge these gaps between us, the way that's going to happen, I think, is to speak from some place of common ground, to speak to one another's priorities and values.
It's interesting, actually, because sesame, tahina, hummus, you know, there's a connected dots there. And in my head, I'm remembering this Israeli chef I met once who wants to write this book, like the magnum opus of the chickpea, and talk about all the ways that chickpea and hummus are important to him as an Israeli, but also important to all the cultures of the Middle East. And, you know, this is a region where obviously there's a lot of strife, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of conflict. And he's like, look, we all eat chickpeas.
Right. There's so much crossover and mixing and melding of flavors and ingredients in that region because there is so much similarity in origin and background. And in Tianlan's piece about sesame, she points to this interesting example of, you know, some of the best tahini factories are Palestinian run. And but that ingredient is so important to Israelis. Like, they have brokered a way in which the rabbis can monitor the factories to make sure everything is kosher. And then they have special permits that allow the delivery trucks to travel across the West Bank. And it's like, it's incredible. Like, given as much conflict as there is there, this ingredient, this taste, this flavor is so important. Like, we can make peace for that. Like, we can't make peace for other things. But, like, let's at least make a little temporary peace for good tahini.
Yeah. It's also, I don't know, like, yeah, like you said, like, I don't want to get too much into the geopolitics of it because I'm dumb and don't know anything about it. But, like, a lot of conflicts are political, and they're at the level of the government, and they're at the level of political leadership. And on a daily person level, it's like, look, I love that tahina. I just want to be able to eat it. I want you to be able to make it. And I want to be able to pay you money for it. Like, come on.
Yes. And that's so relevant here, too, isn't it, Francis? Like, a lot of these arguments about immigration, border security, they're happening in the abstract in terms of politics when, you know, I think that regardless of which side of the political spectrum you're on, your day-to-day experience of other people, of immigrants, isn't defined by what you're hearing in the political arena. It's defined by your day-to-day experience of it, like the people that you run into, the foods that you eat. And again, I'm not trying to look at this with rose-colored glasses and say, you know, we eat Mexican food and therefore we can, you know, all agree that we should have open borders with Mexico. Like, that's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm just saying we should try to dwell in commonality in order to have constructive conversations.
Mm. Well, okay, there's another side of it too, though, right? There's another piece in the book by Osai Endelin, and her article is about fried chicken. And my understanding of what she was saying in that article is that in some ways saying we all eat the same can be a problem, right? Because in her essay, it's like, yeah, everyone loves fried chicken. I love fried chicken. You love fried chicken. People around the world fried chicken. But then to just flatten it all out and say, hey, everyone loves fried chicken is to ignore the fact that in the United States, for a huge part of our history, frying chicken was something that black people did largely for other people, and their specific history is ignored. You know, no one can say who invented it, but it was produced in black kitchens for commercial clientele, largely white clientele, for a really long time. And, you know, if it's like, oh, well, everyone loves it, everyone eats it, then, like, that history is ignored, and those people don't get credit. If anything, it's turned into this gross stereotype about black people, you know, love and eat fried chicken.
Yes. Yeah. The problem and the difficulty with the conversation that we're having in food media here, and by and large, this conversation is happening largely in food media and not at your average dinner table, about cultural appropriation, or what Krishnendu Rey calls in this book culinary misappropriation, is that people want defined rules. The people who are trying to cook food that was originated with somebody else want to know what's off limits. They want to know how to do it right. And those who feel ownership over it can't necessarily provide those rules. When it comes to fried chicken, we do have to make special dispensation in this kind of idea of togetherness and unity and sharing of ingredients and ideas for people, for African-Americans specifically, whose history and contributions to the culinary canon in America have been systematically erased and minimized and trampled over. And that piece that she's writing about is not just sort of shaking her fist and saying that. It's sure. saying that we all like fried chicken, vegetarians notwithstanding. So if we can all agree on that, can we also agree to share some of the weight of its history? That piece starts with a guy named Morgan McGlone. And Morgan runs a hot chicken shop or several hot chicken shops in Australia. And he's a half Maori, half Irish guy, cooking hot chicken, which is, you know, a subspecies of fried chicken invented in Nashville, halfway across the world. And he's serving it to people who, by and large, have no idea about the history of fried chicken. And to know Morgan is to know, like, just one of the most generous and kind and thoughtful people cooking food. And when I think of him and when I talk to Osai about him, I was just kind of like, what can we just use him as a case study? Can we think about a person that we really like and respect, but who's doing something that we're not entirely sure is okay? Can you just serve natural hot chicken without the context, without the culinary history halfway around the world? Mm-hmm. And there's no straightforward answer, and there's no way for me to say, like, you're allowed to do this. You're allowed to serve Nashville hot chicken anywhere you want, so long as you're a nice guy who speaks four languages and I know not to be racist. Like that, that's just like patently not possible unless people want to make me like a cool judge of that sort. Like I'll take that job, but that's why it's complicated. And just trying to know and trying to like ask the questions and have the conversations is the best that I've got so far. Like that's as far as I can take it. And having these conversations is as good as I can do for now.
Yeah. No easy answers.
Exactly.
So life's big questions. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Ying is the editor of the book You and I Eat the Same. And you know, I think about the thing he brings up at the end of that interview a lot, because people get really, really upset if they ever think anyone is trying to tell them what they, quote unquote, are allowed to cook. And yes, of course you can cook tapas if you're Irish, and French food if you're Japanese, and hey, you know, most of the line cooks at that very nice Italian restaurant you went to last week are probably Guatemalan. But the question is, if you're selling and making money with the food of the people who've been historically looked down upon, are you doing it in a way that helps uplift people? Like maybe people who were raised in that culture and that helps them tell their own stories? I mean, like Chris said, no one asked me to judge, right? But I think we can all agree that we should be thanking and honoring the people who've taught us and inspired us, right? In the end, I think it's really just about respect and good faith. And anyway, if you listen to that interview and really just want recipes for some sesame, check out splendidtable.org. There are literally hundreds of recipes that use sesame, like Nigella Lawson's butterfly chicken with miso and sesame seeds. Coming up, food journalist Bea Wilson on the worldwide disappearance of lunch. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Here's a thing we all seem to have in common. Lunch is disappearing. From once sacred lunch and siesta culture to hashtag sad desk lunch, lunchtime as a time to recharge and, I don't know, live a life worth living? Looks like it's going away. Shauna Seaver talked with food historian Bea Wilson about what's going on.
Hi, Bea. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I have to ask you, what happened to lunch? Where did it go? When do you think it became a luxury to take a pause in the day specifically to eat? At what point in time do you think lunch took a backseat?
I think it's been happening for a while, but I really think the change has happened largely in the Western world since the 1960s. I interviewed someone who was a nurse in British hospitals in the 1960s, and she was saying that the lunch break used to be like a pause in music. It was there to break up the rhythms, to refresh you, to revive you for what came next. And lunch breaks used to be not just something you were entitled to, but you were kind of expected to stop and sit down and have lunch all at the same time as your co-workers. Whereas now, even if people have a lunch break, there's a sort of sense that you ought to be using it for something more important, supposedly, than eating, whether it's going and doing a super fast workout at the gym or catching up with your online shopping or checking yet more emails. And I find it really sad because lunchtime, it wasn't just about food, it wasn't just about ingesting nutrients. It was about the rhythms and rituals of the day. And we lose a huge amount when we just lose that moment of sitting down, potentially making eye contact, or at the very least, looking at your food before you eat it.
Something I hadn't considered before reading your book is that fact that having a traditional lunch hour, say noon to 1 o'clock, which is fairly traditional, I think, it gives a communal rhythm to the day. So even if we're eating lunch alone, we know that others around us are doing the same thing somewhere, and somehow there's comfort in that. What do you think the impact is of losing the sense of communal eating?
I think it's huge. I think you've put your finger on it. I think it makes us feel alone and slightly chaotic and at sea. There's this word, commensality, and it used to mean eating at the same table. And there's an anthropologist called Claude Fischler who said that commensality is what provides the basic human script of eating in every society, this idea that we're sort of synchronizing our eating. And as you say, people have always eaten alone. There've always been times when people ate hurried meals or ad hoc meals, or they just took a bit of bread and meat and put it in their sandwich and went off to the fields to work. But what there hasn't been is this sense that eating could happen at any time of the day, and it's just this thin ribbon when you might choose to have your lunch at 10 a.m. and I choose to have it at 3 p.m. And I was fascinated. I came across some graphs that were studying the kind of use of time that people had in Europe from the 1990s up to the early 2000s. And what these graphs show is there are still societies, or there were then still societies such as Spain and France, where you can see there are these distinct bulges of time around midday and then again in the evening when everyone, give or take, is eating. Whereas in the Anglo-Saxon world, in the UK and presumably in the States as well, eating is just this thin ribbon of time, and there's no set pattern and there's no sense of duty about when to eat it, which in a sense could feel liberating, but I think it also feels quite scary.
I loved those graphs. I thought that they were really impactful, and it shows just how much it's shifted. Is it in about the past 10 years or so, some of those places that used to hold lunch sacred aren't doing so anymore? Is that about the right time frame?
Yes, I would say in about the past 10 years, even in Spain, even in Italy, even in France, there's now this sense that we ought to be hurrying from one task to the next. And it's sad. And the signs are that it's not just that we're losing out on this nice period of rest when workers can just sit down and regroup. It's actually impacting our health. There were various things I came across that suggested this. There was a really important piece of research done in the late 60s in the Bay Area of San Francisco, where a team of researchers looked at Japanese American men and their risk of coronary heart disease. And what they found was that as these men had moved from Japan to the US, their risk of heart disease went up in every case. But some of the groups of men were at much lower risk of heart disease than others. And what they found was that it wasn't actually what these men were eating that made the difference, but how they were eating it. So the ones that had lower risk of heart disease, they were the ones that were culturally the most Japanese. In other words, they were still eating in a communal way. They were still making time for food. They still spent time with their families when they were eating. And we sort of think that that's almost a matter of no importance. Our culture talks about food as if it's just a matter of carbs and fat and vitamins. And we completely forget the how of eating, which may turn out to be the most important part.
So how can we bring it back? Will the traditional lunch hour ever return?
I really hope so. I mean, I kind of fear, I mean, it feels really sad, like so many things in our food culture, that we may be forced into making change by the fact that so many people's health is suffering for a lack of a lunch hour. You can see it with nurses who are at a much higher risk of obesity than the general population. And sometimes people make this judgmental comment of, well, they're healthcare workers, how can they not set a good example? But actually, the reason that nurses are at higher risk of obesity is because they have no time in the day at all to stop. And they may have only access to unhealthy vending machines on site. We desperately need employers to see that allowing your employees time to sit, to stop, maybe to reflect, even if you're only eating a sandwich or whatever it might be, that time is part of the component that nourishes us.
And we see it coming back almost on social media, sort of the cool thing to do with the hashtag not sad desk lunch, you know, things like that, where it's become almost celebrated if you can take the time to do this for yourself. It's become one more thing for us to aspire to, I suppose. But what are some practical ways to ensure that we're making lunch a priority for ourselves and that we're doing it in a healthy way?
I think I feel quite encouraged by that trend. There's that whole vogue, isn't there, for meal prepping. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, as with everything on social media, it goes slightly obsessive compulsive, and you have these people making these absolutely perfect rectangular glass dishes of amazing food that they're bringing in for the next 5 days. But on the upside, I feel there is this vogue of people saying, no, I'm not just going to settle for some sad, drooping sandwich that costs too much and doesn't give me much pleasure. I'm actually going to cook a bit more of something delicious the night before, and then I'm going to open my box of food. And it's almost like a gift to yourself when you have a delicious lunch that you packed from home. So even if you have only got 20 minutes for your lunch, as opposed to the full hour that people might have enjoyed in the past, at least you can sit and enjoy that. I think that's been a really good trend, the rise of the packed lunch.
Absolutely.
And other than that, I think it's we need to change our priorities. We need to get back to thinking that eating lunch during your lunch hour is not actually a waste of time. It's kind of what the lunch hour was designed for. And sometimes food needs to shift back up our list of priorities. Sometimes the emails can wait.
They definitely can. And now I'm very hungry. Thank you so much, Bea.
Me too. Thank you.
Bea Wilson's forthcoming book is called The Way We Eat Now. And Shauna Seaver's latest book is called Real Sweet. And we do have some lunchtime inspiration for you. It's a recipe for Hungarian casino egg salad from the book Artisan Jewish Deli at Home by Nick Zukin and Michael Zussman. And it is delicious. Find it at splendidtable.org. Say you own a restaurant, which means now you're in the business of making customers happy, right? Would you insist that the customers have to eat their food hot, with exactly 3 shakes of hot sauce and always with an iced tea? Probably not. But this next story, from America's Test Kitchen reporter Alex DePalma and their podcast Proof, is about why a certain legendary burger place will never, ever, ever let you have ketchup.
When outsiders think of New Haven, they usually think of Yale University. But those of us from there know that the real New Haven institution isn't Yale, it's Louis' Lunch. So Louis' Lunch is spelled L-O-U-I-S, like Louis, but it's pronounced Louis, sometimes Lou's. And Lou's is well known for a couple of different reasons. The main one being that, according to the Library of Congress and Louis' owners, they are the birthplace of the American hamburger. And that's probably why the status of the birthplace of the American hamburger is what gives them this authority for number two, which is their ketchup policy. And that policy is no ketchup allowed ever.
First of all, it's much enlarged from the original site. The outside is just this cute little brick building. And all the windows are round on the top, and they have these shutters that they close every night, and they put these huge old locks on.
That is my dad, Donald. He's been bringing me to Lou's for my entire life. The first burger I ever remember eating was a Lou's burger. We'd always get burgers and sit at the booth where we could watch them cook. And as I got older, I always remember being embarrassed to see the Christmas card photo of me and my sister hanging on a string that went across the restaurant.
The counter is wood. There's wood everywhere. The walls are wood, the ceiling's wood, everything's wood. And there's carvings everywhere of people's initials from forever.
Lou's started in 1895 as a lunch wagon. It's one of the oldest family-run businesses in America, currently owned and operated by Jeff Lassen, Lou's great-great-grandson and the fourth generation of Lassen to run the place.
My name's Jeff Lassen, and I'm the fourth generation proprietor of Louis' Lunch. My great-grandfather, Louis Lassen, started it in 1895. And in the year 1900, he made the first hamburger sandwich in the United States.
Even though the restaurant is over 120 years old, not much has changed. Today, they make and cook their burgers the exact same way they did during World War I. A proprietary blend of 5 cuts of beef, ground fresh daily, and cooked in the very same upright cast iron grills that they had in the original store.
They're cooked in the same stoves, vertical gas broilers that are dated from 1898, so they're 120 years old. They're upright, so we cook vertically as opposed to on a flat top. There's a flame on either side, and they're cast iron, and they look like antique stoves.
I can't, looking at them, you would never think that they work.
It's amazing, but back then in the 1900s, if you made something, you made it to last, because if you didn't, you were out of business. Even the toaster is from 1929.
Really?
Yes, 89 years old. Well, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
From the time that Lou's started in 1895, they were completely focused on the quality of the meat. Here is unofficial Lou's historian, Cam, talking about the original Louis Lassen.
He would go down to the meat house and select, I think it was a third of side of beef whole. He would purchase it whole and then bring it back and cut it down and then mince it down so that every burger was a specific proportion of the shoulder to the all the parts of the meat. I mean, the art of blending it. And as he said, that's why he never put ketchup, because you mask the taste of the burger.
When you walk into Louis, there used to be a sign, and I specifically remember this because there was a swear word in it, but the sign said, "This is not Burger King. You do not get it your way. You take it my way or you don't get the damned thing." And they have taken that sign down, but the no ketchup ever rule is still very, very much in effect. And I would be lying if I said that this did not anger some people along the way. If you Google Louis' lunch or if you do a quick search through Yelp, you will surely find a few scathing reviews. Here's my favorite Yelp review from one ketchup-loving customer. "The biggest problem I have with Louis is their ban on ketchup. Don't," this is all in caps, "don't tell me what I can and cannot put on my hamburger," back to lowercase. "If I want ketchup on my burger, I'm going to put ketchup on it. I ordered takeout, so when I got back to work, I put ketchup on it anyway." That's the review. But let me be clear about this. For every one person who gets upset at Louis for not serving ketchup, there are so many more who are lifelong Louis customers and who would never, ever dream of putting ketchup on a precious Louis burger. So for the argument in favor of the ketchupless burger, I would like to submit Exhibit A.
No, my father would never sell it. He'd just let it go out of business. We've been approached twice, my father first, by a company that shall remain anonymous, and they offered him $5 million around 1975. Quicker than you could blink, he turned them down.
Really? Was that a conversation? Like, did your whole family have that, like, discussion, or was it just like, that's not... Like,
no. My dad was like, no, no, thank you. I'm not interested. Thanks anyhow. And then about 15 years ago, maybe a little more, I was offered $51 million to...
Wait, really? 51? And you just, you didn't even consider it?
Not as quick as my dad. Truth be told, unfortunately, but probably took me about 5 minutes, maybe a little less, and I said no.
Because?
Everything that my forefathers put into this and myself and the hours and the time and the tears and everything my father did to try and save it back in the day. And I couldn't see myself doing that.
What I'm saying is they might be onto something here, which brings me to Exhibit B.
Can I tell the story as I remember?
Sure.
They used to be in a building. It was an office of an old tannery complex.
We moved into this building in 1917. And then when they actually picked it up and moved it up here in 1975. And then in the...
Okay, so what happened was this. In the late 60s, early 70s, New Haven's mayor at the time, a guy named Richard Lee, and the city government were pushing hard for new developments. They had these visions of turning New Haven into one of the East Coast's model cities, whatever that means. They needed to make space for all of these new development projects, and one of the spaces they wanted was the land that the original Lou's Lunch was sitting on. So the mayor and the city government tried to bully Jeff's dad, Ken Lassen, into shutting down or moving. But Ken was the third generation owner of Lou's, and he was also the type of guy who doesn't step down from a fight. Cam loves telling this story.
I mean, it's a real tale of urban corruption. So every time they'd come up with some sort of phony thing of why it would be moved, Ken would come up with documentation and just kept disproving them all the time. I mean, he was a real pain in the ass for them.
This battle between Ken Lassen and the New Haven city government went on for almost 10 years. During that decade, the community rallied around Lou's. The showdown was in the newspaper all the time, and devoted customers staged a write-in to Washington, D.C. to save Lou's. They even had the support of the military at one point.
So all of a sudden, all this publicity was coming out all over the place. I was told there was a bunch of Marines who wanted to chain themselves around the building.
I had heard that. He almost fought for almost 10 years, my father.
At Lou's, longtime customers end up becoming family. This is something that I experienced through my years of going there with my dad. And Lou's burgers become part of a family meal. And to me and to so many of the customers that go there, that's really what makes the place so unique, especially in, and it's kind of a reference back to that sign, this is not Burger King, in a time when there are so many places like Burger King or places where you can get it however you want with no personal connection, Louis is really a place that makes you feel like family. So no, a Louis burger does not need ketchup because it has something else.
Do you come here a lot?
As often as possible, many years. Since before my son was born, and he's 37.
So what's your order? What's your go-to order that you always have?
Cheese works.
What's on the cheese works?
Cheese, tomato, onion, a burger, and some toast.
Do you ever get sad that you don't have ketchup on the burger?
No.
Why?
Because it tastes so good just the way it is. The way it is, it's perfect for me.
Alex DePalma reported this story for the podcast Proof. And that's it for our show this week. I am sorry that we have not yet totally figured out if all people truly eat the same or if we are all totally different. We'll keep thinking about it. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and is supported by you. Thanks for all your amazing generosity this past year. We can't do any of this without you. Go to splendidtable.org to support our program. And while you're there, feel free to spend some time. You can take a look at our recipe collection. You can sign up for our weekly email called Weeknight Kitchen. And don't forget to sign up for our podcast. If you like them, leave them a review. It really, really helps us out. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.